I can tell you right now, in this moment, I think the most important thing to do, and maybe it's not for really radical people, maybe this is a message for others, is that especially in the next couple weeks, if there's a far-right demonstration, we need to have one that swamps them, that makes it very clear the communities don't want this stuff, you know, outnumber them 10 to 1, 20 to 1. Their demonstrations aren't that big. And this should have been happening all along, but now is really the time for people in the more moderate political factions to step up and do this, and people who are more radical to, even if you've been rebuffed in the past, to attempt to make overtures to these organizations and see if you can get people out. And, you know, the Capitol takeover is a good hook for it. You're like, do you want to see that here? People are horrified by it. Do you want to see that here? The police aren't going to stop it, you know, whether that's true or not. Mm-hmm. It's a good selling point. And it's time to show up and, you know, make it clear that the community is not going to tolerate these things.
Defend your Constitution! Defend your liberty! Yes. Defend your Constitution! Defend your liberty! Defend your Constitution!
Hey everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. In this episode, I speak with Spencer Sunshine. Spencer is a researcher, writer, activist, speaker, and political consultant regarding far-right movements. He also has a doctorate in sociology, and in 1990, he co-founded an anti-racist youth group in the metro Atlanta, Georgia, to combat the influence of the Nazi skinhead movement, which was hegemonic in the local punk scene. Since 2005, he has written extensively about the U.S. far right. This includes post-war fascism, the Patriot Militia movement, left-right crossover movements, as well as anti-Semitic currents on both the left and right. He was also present at the armed takeover of Oregon's Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in January 2016, and in August 2017, he was part of the counter-demonstration against the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and was in the crowd during the car attack which killed Heather Heyer and injured about 30 others. I've had Spencer on the podcast twice before, as I mentioned there, reading his bio. The first time I actually spoke to him was in 2017, where he, as it stated there, he was part of the counter-demonstration against the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. So that was the very first time that I became exposed to Spencer's work. I've interviewed him once since then, and now I really wanted to have him back on the podcast to discuss the events on January 6th at the Capitol. Of course, everybody at this point should be aware, here in the United States, we had tens of thousands, 10,000-20,000 people storm the Capitol building while Congress was in session in order to verify the Electoral College votes. Yeah, we all know what happened, right? The images, the videos that came out, we all have a pretty good sense of what led up to that event. Of course, Trump was holding a rally outside of the Capitol at that time, basically directed the crowd to, you know, stop the steal, right? Because that's the narrative that's been constructed and the groundwork that has been laid by Trump and his cronies, his allies, for really for years now, and especially in the past several months since the election. So this was the inevitable and logical outcome of years of this kind of dog whistling, of this sort of stochastic terrorism that Trump has engaged in. It's all pretty apparent now why that all played out the way it did. So I brought Spencer on because I really wanted to get a sense of, there's a couple things I really wanted to talk about. One of the major things, of course, was just to get a sense of, through his research and his understanding of far-right organizing and far-right movements in the United States, particularly with the fact that Trump is now exiting the political scene, at least as president, what we can expect from the far-right in the coming years based on the trends that we have seen. But we start this conversation by talking about a recent article that he had published at the Daily Beast. The title of that is, "I've been tracking the far right for years, then Lynn Wood exposed me as the QAnon shaman." I'm going to quote that title really gives you a good idea of what it's about. If y'all remember QAnon shaman, I think his name is something like Jake Angeli or something like that. You know, he's this guy that was dressed up as just the most ludicrous outfit, you know, with these fur pelts and these like Viking-esque horns, and he's, you know, topless with tattoos, and he was in the halls of Congress during this raid or this siege or whatever you want to call it. And basically, I mean, Spencer lays it out really well, but I just want to quote something from this article in which he states, "So how did I come to be the face, or rather the name behind somebody else's face, of a right-wing campaign to deny crimes committed by other right-wingers? What unfolds is a decade-long tale of an ever-morphing conspiracy theory about me, originally forged in the crucible of neo-Nazi anti-Semitism and developed by a variety of small-time far-right figures before a Trumpist grifter injected it onto a national stage. And it is also a story about how purely anti-Semitic conspiracies get toned down and then circulated more broadly while retaining the same storyline and targeting the same individuals." So that gives you an idea of what the at least the first part of this interview is about, addressing what he discussed in that article. And then we move on to discuss another article he'd published a little bit before that at Truthout. The title of that is "Trump Loyalist Breach of Capitol is Likely to Embolden Far-Right Street Forces." And I will quote that because, again, this really gives you an idea of what we discuss in this interview. He states, "The dramatic events yesterday at the U.S. Capitol further open worrisome possibilities for future far-right violence and disruptions. An escalation in aggressive action seems likely, especially in the remaining 2 weeks of Trump's term, but the effect may last much longer. However, there is also the possibility that both this and similar recent events could further widen the internal fissures on the right to the detriment of the Trumpists. Most immediately, Trump loyalist breach of the Capitol will undoubtedly embolden far-right street forces who believe that the election was stolen. There were far-right demonstrations outside state capitals yesterday, although contrary to rumors, none were breached." He states also, "Protesters who entered the Kansas State House had a permit to do so. The most immediate worry is that between now and Joe Biden's inauguration on January 20th, the Capitol breach will act as an inspiration for similar aggressive actions, if not on Thursday, then on the upcoming weekend." Now, I'm ending that quote there, and I just want to state that I'm recording this on January 19th. I'm going to have this episode out tomorrow on the 20th, the day of inauguration. So, yeah, there were some small things that occurred, I think, over the past week and a half or so since the 6th. And who knows what'll happen tomorrow on the 20th. Obviously, there are, like, what, tens of thousands of National Guard that are stationed at the Capitol in D.C. right now. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do get the sense from just talking with Spencer and just seeing the escalation of far-right terror and violence in the streets over just the past year. And just since 2017, right, we can understand, based on everything that's just happened just very, very recently, that there are, you know, there's a sizable portion of the population in this country that is on the edge. I mean, they feel that their president had the election stolen from him. But Spencer just having the experience that he's had within, you know, anti-fascist organizing and just researching far-right movements, basically, yeah, we should anticipate and expect more of these kind of explosive events to happen, whether that's on the small scale or on the larger national scale as well, unfortunately. But all that being said, I just want to point people towards a pamphlet that Spencer had written. Title of that is 40 Ways to Fight Nazis, 40 Community-Based Actions You Can Take to Resist White Nationalist Organizing. That's for free. You can download it for free. I'll be putting a link to the website where you can find that, which is at showingupforracialjustice.org. I'll be providing that link in the description. I will also be providing links to Spencer's most recent article at Truthout, as well as the Daily Beast article, which I really highly recommend you read those articles. Very good, very clear about what we can expect in the coming few weeks, few months, as we continue down this very steady decline here in the United States. So, yeah, and if you want to learn more about Spencer specifically, of course, you can go to his website, spencersunshine.com, and you can also support his work at Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/spencersunshine, and you can sign up for his newsletter. I'll be providing a link to that, and also you can follow him on social media, especially on Twitter at transform6789. So please go check out Spencer's work. And if you would like to learn more about my work specifically, you can go to my website, lastbornthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work monetarily, there's a couple ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal or Venmo. You go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, make a donation there, or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. If you'd like to support my work on a regular monthly basis, you can do that at Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/lastbornwilderness. Any contribution there is just really greatly appreciated, and you'll gain early access to these interviews before they are released publicly there by supporting my work, and you'll gain access to some other exclusive content as well. All right, everyone, thank you so much for your attention, and without any further delay, here is my interview with Spencer Sunshine. Well, Spencer, thanks for coming back on the podcast. It's been a few, over a year or so, I think, since we spoke last. And I was thinking, leading up to this interview, about the first time I had you on the podcast, which is, I think, it was back in 2017, and it was right after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville. And I remember that interview really well, just because you were like, I was there. I saw what happened, and I was a part of the counter-demonstrators. And of course, we know that how bad that event really was, with the murder of Heather Heyer and everything. And you've just been tracking the far right for so long. You have such a great analysis of how these movements organize and how to effectively counter that. But just with the events that have happened in the past, so it's been a little over a week now, I really wanted to catch up with you again. And especially this article you published about 2 or 3 days ago, The Daily Beast, which I want you to talk about because it's really fascinating and actually really disturbing. The title of that is, I've been tracking the far right for years, then Lynn Wood exposed me as the QAnon shaman. Lynn Wood being Trump's attorney, challenging all these legal challenges that Trump has been making against the election. And of course, the QAnon shaman being an individual named Jake Angeli, who was arrested. And he's one of these iconic figures that's come up with the Capitol, the coup attempt that happened at the Capitol. How would you describe this person, this QAnon shaman?
He was the figure who was photographed on the Senate dais with horns and face paint and furs and a spear. Mm. And I believe he describes himself as a psychedelic shaman with the kind of crackpot spiritual beliefs that you would expect to go with that.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's astounding, though, is that, again, Lynn Wood would say that you, Spencer Sunshine, are the QAnon shaman. And now that sort of tracks in the sense that, of course, we've been hearing that, it wasn't really the Trump people, the MAGA people, wouldn't really commit this act of political violence. It was actually Antifa that had infiltrated them and done all this. So that's, of course, the scapegoat they always go with now. But I'm curious, can you just tell us, how did this happen? How do you get targeted in this way? What led up to this?
So this is sort of the high point, at least I hope it's the high point, of a multi-year anti-Semitic conspiracy theory that has been following me, that was originally cooked up by neo-Nazis and then sort of moved into the a little less Nazified far right. I'll tell you this story. I'll tell it backwards. So Lynn Wood, I was watching the demonstration at the Capitol on some live feeds, and someone tweeted me, oh, this guy, a copy of Lynn Wood's tweet claiming I was the QAnon shaman. And I didn't know who Lynn Wood was, so I didn't think much of it. For the last week, conspiracy theorists have been talking about me a little bit, which is not unusual for me. Mm-hmm. And then I slowly, as people started calling me, people I hadn't talked to in a long time, ex-girlfriends of mine I hadn't spoken to in a long time, I was like, let me look at this thing again. And I realized he had a million followers on Twitter. And so that's clearly enough to start a conspiracy theory. This was the day of the, Capitol takeover. The talk had already started that was really Antifa creating the violence. Mm-hmm. So I actually knew I could track back how he had come to this idea, because I track when people talk about, because I have to follow the far right anyway and take screenshots of when they say crazy stuff about me, because there's been a morphing conspiracy theory for 5 or 10 years. And so he said it because there was this I call him the fraudster, this guy who is some outlandish conspiracy theorist who had spent 10 years in jail for a phishing scam and filed all these, like, I think hundreds of frivolous lawsuits, who had claimed, I was on assignment a few years ago to cover the mother of all rallies that was, if people remember, right after Charlottesville was done at the same time as the Juggalo rally in D.C., I went there to cover it on assignment for Color Lines, and this guy started shouting that I was Antifa, and basically I got surrounded by Proud Boys and, you know, almost beaten up. But it was 4 years ago, so you could actually escape that happening. Like, now that wouldn't happen. He had gotten this information from 4chan and 8chan because all these neo-Nazis were talking about me being at Charlottesville. They had gotten this information from a couple other fascists who had decided that I was like the leader of Antifa. And this is partly based on a talk I gave 10 years ago now on the invite of Rose City Antifa about the influence of anti-Semitism on left-wing circles. They're having problems with like Holocaust deniers and related people in sort of progressive circles in Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. And then between this, at some point, a guy named Daniel McMahon, who was a very active troll online who threatened all kinds of people and tried to dox them after Charlottesville, became obsessed with me, decided I was like the number one, his number one enemy. I was like on a hit list, a Nazi hit list of Antifa at Charlottesville, and I was like number three. Wow. McMahon went to prison actually for threatening a black man who was running for office. So, I mean, this is how outlandish his stuff was. He was the closest social media contact of the Bowers, the guy who committed the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, which made me think, oh, did Bowers, who was reading all this stuff about me being the head of Antifa, like, think about killing me? So the stuff that started as a conspiracy theory that I was, like, the Jew Antifa ideologue leader became sort of washed out over the years, and then got picked up by this attorney who I guess was looking for a face of Antifa on one hand. And on the other hand, I think he threw, you know, QAnon shaman under the bus. Maybe he thought he was delegitimizing their struggle or something by looking so outlandish. I sent him a DM on Twitter to ask, you know, the shaman why he did this. But by the time he got it, I believe he was arrested. So he hasn't answered. So that's the conspiracy theory. One of the lessons of this is that if you're on the far right, you know, your colleagues aren't going to hesitate to throw you under the bus when it's convenient for them.
Right. Yeah, it's so, like, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine what it would feel like to be in your position. I know you've been doing this for a long time, and you've, as you've just kind of laid out there, you've been targeted numerous times by the far right. And I mean, like, what does it feel like to be considered the leader of Antifa? I mean, I don't know how even to ask that question, but it's just, that's got to be such a surreal and actually very frightening thing. I would assume. I mean, you basically have a target on you, right?
Yeah, well, I want to say first, anyone who publicly writes about the far right is going to get harassed and is going to get death threats. This is going to be extra for people who are Jewish, usually people of color. Women will get flooded with rape threats. You know, even if you're a straight white man, you will still get death threats if you're an anti-fascist. So on one hand, I'm kind of with everyone else. On the other hand, after Charlottesville, it really was very intense how much chatter there was about me and how many like death threats there were, more than usual. This time, I got death threats and stuff, but it was very funny because it was more like people wanted to talk about me and how terrible I was rather than actually do anything about it. It was kind of funny.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it's funny. You know, I think the conspiracy theories are funny, but they are potentially very deadly. I mean, this is the problem with a lot of Nazis and others on the far right. There's tons of talk about what they want to do, and most of it's, you know, bullshit and hot air, but once in a while it happens. So, you know, I get a little nervous sometimes, but I knew what I was doing when I got into this work. I'd actually done it a little bit of it when I was a teenager. It was how I first got into politics. I was working with a group of adults who were monitoring Klan and Nazi activity in Atlanta, Georgia. I lived outside of the city, and we formed a youth group sort of unofficially affiliated with them. So I knew what this work consisted of, and I didn't think I'd be considered the international leader of Antifa, but I knew I would get death threats and people would try to go after me. So
right. Yeah, I suppose it just comes with the territory. And yeah, I just hope that you are safe and that, you know, you have everything you need to feel somewhat secure as much as possible. I mean, it's just such a, it seems like a really volatile situation in the U.S. right now. And I have no ability or, you know, my main work right is just to interview people and get my understanding through these types of interviews. So, I mean, based on your understanding, like, I just, like you said, you know, you were, I guess, targeted by Proud Boys publicly at one point, and you were able to get out of that situation without being attacked physically.
Well, I was at a demonstration, and right. The guy, the fraudster, started yelling my name and that I was Antifa. There were Proud Boys there, and so there's a video of this online. They literally surrounded me, mm-hmm. and were trying to goad me into fighting them. You know, they got directly in my face, and were trying to—I mean, it's stupid stuff, like trying to make fun of my name. And I just, like, you know, it was really kindergarten stuff. It was a friend of mine who was a photographer was standing right there. It was an ex-Marine who was like, "I was ready to take them down if they went after you." But, you know, I mean, I was lucky. I mean, I was lucky because it was now they would just attack me. You know, I put my hands behind my back, and I could be very, very sort of blank, you know, when I want to be. So that helped. You know, they want to antagonize people, and if you don't allow yourself to be antagonized, they don't have any other tools in their toolbox.
Right.
And then I think they play the national anthem on the stage, and so they all, like, turned around, you know, put their hands on their hearts or whatever. And so I like sneaked out of the little circle, and they didn't want to break ranks, you know. Literally, that's how it happened.
Wow.
Then I went over as fast as I could to the Juggalo rally.
Yeah, it was a Juggalo thing, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which was cool. I liked it. I was like, oh, man, this is like the old, like, countercultural festivals in the 90s and stuff. Like, it was like a nice vibe. There was like DSA people there who were like just handing water out. They weren't trying to proselytize. So I was like, oh, right. This is actually really nice. I like this.
Wow. Okay. But I imagine that the if you were in a similar situation with the same groups of people, that maybe the situation would be different now. Do you feel that it's, I mean, I just feel like now, like, you could have been actually physically attacked. I feel like that's like where we're at right now. Is that what you get a sense of?
Yeah. The whole thing, I mean, you know, we still know Heather Heyer's name and think about Charlottesville, but like one person was killed at Charlottesville, and that was such a big impact. Now people are killed at demonstrations regularly and people don't flinch, you know? There's been so much. People remember the first sort of incursion of violence into political movements, but usually the violence gets much more intense. And we've seen that all over the place. Various murders and counter murders and people being, you know, oh my God, at Charlottesville, someone ran a car into a crowd. Well, how many dozens of car attacks were there on Black Lives Matter demonstrations? And now we're just like, eh. And a number of people were killed by them. The amount of violence, you know, a police officer was killed by these Trumpists at the Capitol takeover, which really hasn't gotten enough play as it should have. I mean, it's shocking. I can't imagine the left killing a police officer in the U.S. The violence has just become a lot more widespread. You can see even people at the demonstrations are far more militarized, wearing all this gear, people wielding guns at demonstrations very openly. You know, what happened in Kenosha, people being gunned down. So it's been I think people don't quite reflect on how much the level of violence has increased over the last 4 years. And even what we saw in the Capitol takeover, people are like, oh, this is like the second example of Charlottesville. Well, Charlottesville was Nazis and fascists, like almost all fascists. It was a fascist-led and organized demonstration with like a handful of other people. Mm-hmm. Whereas what happened at the Capitol was much more politically moderate people, which is much scarier, right? That sort of militant, violent tactics are moving just from the most extreme people into what's more like the mainstream of the GOP. And that's really scary.
Yeah, and I you talked about that. There's a police officer that was killed. What does that indicate to you? Like, the fact that, because when I think of these MAGA people, They're very much like All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter. They have the thin blue line, American flags. They're very like, I mean, just how they present themselves, they're like very pro-police. And then you have that situation where, yes, like police officers were assaulted and one was killed in this siege. I mean, what is that? What it feels like a threshold has been crossed. And I'm curious, like, what does that indicate to you?
It's important. And some of these things were preceded by an attack on the Capitol in Salem, Oregon, which I think was a couple weeks before. I can't remember exactly. There's two things that people don't quite realize, I think. One is that the police, while, you know, a lot of them, maybe probably most of them have far-right sympathies, at the end of the day, you know, have to more or less follow the law and more or less be accountable to – they're part of the state structure. And so they may be biased towards the far right in some way, but they can't break ranks with the government, you know, and they're going to support, you know, the state at the end of the day. There may be renegade elements. It does seem at the Capitol that some of them were siding with the protesters, but others were fighting furiously. And even, you know, as we saw, one was killed and another committed suicide afterwards. You know, it seems like he felt like he didn't, you know, behave honorably at that you know, sense of the Capitol. So it's wrong just to see the police as like, oh, they're just far right and they're going to behave like far right actors. The other is for the, you know, Trumpists in general is that they say they back the blue or whatever, but really they just are interested in a repressive apparatus. You know, they're not interested in a professional, you know, neutral police agency, right? Not that the police are, but they don't want it even. They are into the cops because they can repress, you know, black folks and they can shut down leftist demonstrations and they're, you know, politically conservative. But the, at the moment that the far right forces, you know, really breach legality and not against leftists or black liberation people, but like against the state, they're going to realize that the police at the end of the day are the armed, you know, wing of the state, and they're going to be put into conflict. So we saw this in Salem with Proud Boys and others attacked the Capitol, the state Capitol there, and got in a big fight with the police. And the police, you know, did not take their side. And this was sort of a run up to what happened in D.C. And so parts of the, you know, there's clearly debates inside the far right right now about, you know, pro or con police. It's very clear that parts of the heretofore, you know, more moderate, politically moderate, you know, and in this I include the Proud Boys, Trumpist factions are going to break off towards pieces of them will break off towards a more anti-state or anti-current state. You know, they're not anarchist, insurrectionist, more militant political tactics, perhaps joining with neo-Nazis who are already embracing those kinds of things.
Right.
Because they're ultimately going to understand that the police and the military are not are going to defend the government. They're the armed wing of the government. And no matter how sympathetic the members of those institutions are, they're not going to break that.
Right. Well, do you think that this so I imagine Trump will in some form, some way or another, leave in about a week from now. It's on the 20th, his inauguration. And like, is this even about Trump anymore? Especially like I just think of the fallout of this, and that of course the Fed seemed to be arresting people that were involved in the riot or whatever you want to call it, the it's called an insurrection or a coup attempt. Do you think this is going to move like, let's say specifically MAGA people, people who are devoted to Trump, is this going to move them maybe away from Trump and more towards a radical right position? Or like, I guess just what is your sense of that?
Well, yeah, I think Trump is no longer important. He's said he's going to go, and that's important because if he wanted to rally all of his people for one last time, he wouldn't say that, right? That's not a real rallying cry. And so that movement is now going to become an independent movement. You know, at the beginning of all this stuff, I dubbed them independent Trumpists, this whole coalition of groups, because they supported Trump but weren't part of his official apparatus. They weren't necessarily part of the GOP. And there's going to be an independent Trumpist movement that will last afterwards, after he's gone, with more mainstream and more radical factions. you know, we saw this in Argentina with Perón after he was out of power. Peronism continued for decades. There's still Peronists. Mm. So we're going to see Trumpists for quite a while, and they're going to start to take their own path. We'll see what happens. We'll see if Trump continues to try to position himself as a political figure. Perhaps he will keep doing speaking tours, which he loves so much, but he's going to get diminishing returns on the attention, and that's his real interest in this stuff. So perhaps one of his sons will try to pick up his legacy and make themselves a far-right leader. I think, you know, Don Jr. is probably the most likely candidate for that.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see.
Okay.
The movement is going to take its own course. That's, you know, so far it's always been a support group for Trump, and now it's going to take its own course. So it'll be interesting to watch, I think.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about this because, you know, even after the mob invaded the Capitol, they continued the Senate, I guess, Congress people continue to verify the Electoral College votes. There was still a subset of the Republicans that still wanted to block it. Obviously, it wasn't enough to really get in the way of it. And then just seeing with the impeachment, I was watching the impeachment proceedings last night, or yesterday, I should say. And yeah, you've got still, you know, majority of Republicans that are still on the Trump train. And then just information that's been coming out more recently showing that there was at least like five or so representatives in Congress that actually showed people like where to come into the Capitol and like showing them around. The panic buttons were removed. Like obviously there was some sort of inside thing happening there. So I'm curious about your ideas about the Republican Party in general and like what direction it's going to go, and whether it's going to really truly move after Trump leaves and continue to become more, I think, more openly fascist or something like that. But what is your sense of like the Republican Party and the direction they're going in?
Well, I understand why most Republicans don't want to vote for impeachement. I mean, they, you know, in the American political system, you act lockstep with your party on many issues. And this is going to be one of the issues they are. That doesn't mean that majority of the Republicans are really into Trump. I think maybe a quarter of the electeds are into Trump. It's a much higher level of the base. I think once Trump's out, there's going to be a fight for the soul of the party, and that the non-Trumpists who are, you know, furious about what's happened to the party, because they're not crazy. They don't believe in conspiracy theories, and they're just like, we just love the free market or whatever.
Right.
That they're going to try to wrest control of the party again. They're on good grounds because, you know, with politics at the end of the day is nothing succeeds like success. Like, you can say what you want about Trumpism, but it got him elected the first time. Well, now Trumpism didn't get him elected. So not a useful strategy in, you know, is a good argument in terms of realpolitik. And the base is, you know, they're going to be somewhat disillusioned. Some of them are going to leave the party, you know, so there's going to be two splits. There'll be a split in the party of the Trumpists versus the non-Trumpists. And there'll be a split amongst the Trumpists of people who leave the party and don't. There's also, as a kind of third thing, the Groiper movement, which is a mostly white nationalist movement around Nick Fuentes and others who basically have, instead of organizing separate white nationalist groups, are an entryist project into the GOP to try to move the base to the right.
Mm.
So it's interesting, as some parts of the Trumpists are moving to the more radical elements, there are more radical elements that are trying to moving into the center. So we'll see what happens. We'll see if the, you know, I think a lot of the people who are part of the Trumpist base aren't new to politics and were excited by him. And I'm unconvinced they're going to continue to be politically active as long-term political actors, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, when the moment of excitement is over, people get attracted to movements when they're in full swing just because they want action. And then once you get back to boring meetings and, you know, slow movement, a lot of those people fall off. So
right.
I think a lot of the Trumpists are gonna fall off. Kind of like, I don't know if you ever heard these stories where the Klan was very popular in the early 1920s. You know, it was a mass movement with millions of members. This didn't last very long. It was started maybe around 1920, was over in many places by the 1924 election. So all these people quit the Klan, you know, and you always hear stories about people finding, you know, old Klan uniforms, Klan robes, you know, from grandpa up in the attic that he sort of hid away. You know, he was a Klansman, but he quickly left and then was sort of ashamed of it afterwards. Mm. So it also happens that people move through these movements fairly quickly. And when they're done, they're done. They're like, well, it's no longer a mainstream thing to do, so I'm going to move on to the next popular thing or the next acceptable thing. It's acceptable right now, and it won't be acceptable pretty shortly.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Well, another thing that comes...
I hope it won't be acceptable pretty shortly.
Right. Yeah, we hope, right? Yeah. I'm curious about, like, because there's this... Okay, there's kind of two parts to this, and one of it's I want to address this... you know, there's this march on the Capitol, or you know, all 50 states, there's, you know, all the various capitals and all the states are anticipating people to, yes, you know, do basically what they did on the 6th, which is invade the Capitol buildings. Of course, there's what, 20,000 National Guard that have been deployed to stationed in the Capitol leading up to the inauguration, leading up to the 17th. Yeah, I want to know what what do you think? I don't know. There's no way to know the future, but like based on your understanding of these groups organizing, I mean, is that a viable threat? Are we? I guess just what do you anticipate to happen in the coming days, in the coming week, leading up to the inauguration?
I tend to be less alarmist than others, although I'm the first person to say I'm not always right. Hmm. I don't think a lot is going to happen because. People, when these movements, these radical street movements succeed, it's usually because there's a lapse by the security forces. Hmm. This is what happened in the demonstration against the World Trade Organization in Seattle in 1999, which kicked off a big, you know, movement for a number of years, militant movement on the left. And it was because the way the cops policed the demonstration was stupid, and it basically the demonstrators could overrun them. This is what happened in D.C., whether by design or not. I mean, I think... You know, we will find out later if this, to what extent this intentional, this understaffing of the Capitol Police was intentional. I think it's likely that it is, but I hesitate to speculate. Mm-hmm. But now, from now on, I mean, it's offended so many people, including a lot of Republicans. Like, no matter if they are voting against impeachment, it doesn't mean that most of the Republicans aren't super offended at what happened. It's a strike at them, too. You know, I mean, I believe it was Pence who finally authorized the National Guard being brought in. Like, he was being directly threatened. At some point, these guys are going to go, this mob mentality that Trump is unleashing is going to come at us. Like, the Trumpists are also threatening Republicans who aren't on their side. So I think there's just going to be, you know, law enforcement can stop these things. They've always stopped the left demonstration. They've been able to shut down left demonstrations, even really, really large ones when they want to. And I think they're just going to be like elected officials are just going to be like, we've had enough of this. And it's not playing well with the majority of Americans. And I think certainly at the inauguration, they're going to shut it down. As for state capitals, you know, if they want to, they can. If there's sympathetic governors or whatever, they may have more of a chance. We'll see. That one, I think, is more. Certainly there's more possibilities for takeovers or something. Or violence. I think D.C. is just going to be flooded with National Guard and police, and they're not going to have any maneuvering room.
Okay. Yeah, I know this is all speculation, but I mean, based on the trends, and you know, you had an article that you published on Truthout, like the last day of 2020, just sort of going over like the increase of far right violence in the United States. Yeah, I mean, again, it's so hard to truly and accurately know what's going to happen. But I mean, based on what's happening now and on previous the trends that you have observed over the years, what can you kind of anticipate? How do you think they're going to react under a Biden administration, for instance, and with their favorite president leaving office? You know, my sense is that they're going to engage in more acts of one-off terrorist events, almost, or things like that. I'm just curious, like, based on your understanding of the far right and the behavior of those on the far right, like, what can we expect with that?
I think all the monitors are expecting a wave of terrorism or other, you know, close to it actions by people on the far right, by disenchanted Trumpists, because they no longer have a political, they no longer can use mainstream politics as a vehicle. So they're going to use, you know, extra parliamentary tactics. And they believe, you know, the belief that the election is stolen is really going to fuel these things, because they truly believe it. Like, this is the thing. Everyone at that demonstration in D.C. believed the election was stolen. They all just believe a fabrication with no evidence, right? And that's a very dangerous situation. Obviously, right. The far-right people are going to go into – some of it's going to depend on if these independent Trumpists can keep a political, you know, stream together and Trump's role in this. The militias, they're also obviously going to move in an anti-Biden stance. I mean, the left has done well the last 4 years in an anti-Trump stance. So you can – organizing against another political faction is often, you know, useful, or it's not always the best, but sometimes it's very good. The militias are probably in the best position to take advantage of this. Historically, they've kind of gone down under Republican administrations, but they've been able to hitch their, you know, hitch their trailer to the other groups that supported Trump. And they're generally anti-federal government, and they've downplayed this or really kind of dropped this under the Trump administration. But they'll be able to, and those are their core talking points, political talking points, they'll be able to bring them back up to the fore under Biden. So I think they're going to be the group that is most likely to benefit from this. I don't think the Proud Boys are going to do very well. I think people are going to be like, you had your moment and we're done with the violence, you know, just a general deflation of Trump. And the others, we'll see what they do. I mean, you know, I hope the QAnon stuff just goes away. It may linger on as a conspiracy theory and get into conspiracy circles. It's sort of a conglomeration of past conspiracy theories, though. All this stuff about secret pedophiles and Satanists and stuff, these are long-standing right-wing conspiracy theories, you know. Right. So QAnon acts as like a bowl to put all kinds of existing currents in it.
Right, right.
So we'll see. Those are the things that I can pick out the most, you know, coming up. I think a lot of people who entered the fascist movement, and this is an interesting thing. Over the last 4 years, it's the first time in the U.S. we've seen a fascist movement, a big one, you know, a revival of it that's not explicitly neo-Nazi. Like, there's some Nazi elements, but it's much more undifferentiated. Like, you know, people like Richard Spencer, he's not a neo-Nazi. But he's a fascist, you know. We haven't seen this sort of this kind of thing lately, but they'll create a new generation of fascist activists that will continue for a few years. Like, those kinds of things tend to have ups and downs, and when they have ups, it sort of revives the core activists with a new generation and makes them younger, so the other ones don't age out. You know, so it doesn't age out altogether.
Right. Could you elaborate on that point a little more about how Richard Spencer is not a neo-Nazi but is a fascist? I mean, I understand there's probably distinction. There is distinctions between these two things, but I'm curious, like, what are the distinctions? Like, you're saying a real fascist movement has really emerged in the United States, but it isn't explicitly like a neo-Nazi ideology. Like, so could you explain that a bit and differentiate the two?
Well, I mean, people already know this if you think about it. Mussolini was a fascist, but he wasn't a Nazi. You know, Nazism and neo-Nazism are one kind of fascism. So if we're talking about the actual fascist movement, not someone who may act like a fascist like Trump or something, but, you know, it's a coherent movement. It's existed since, some people argue, since the late 1800s, certainly since the late 19-teens, early 20s is when Mussolini came to power. So, I mean, neo-Nazis act in a specific way, have a specific discourse, often look a certain way, and Richard Spencer's not part of that. Neo-Nazis criticize Richard Spencer, and most of them don't like him. Spencer is much more like a traditional white nationalist, and there has long been longstanding tensions between neo-Nazis and other white nationalists. I mean, I consider neo-Nazis one kind of white nationalist in the United States. But, you know, there's a lot of tension between the different factions, so a lot of them don't like the neo-Nazis. Nazism produces this reaction from people that all white nationalism doesn't. you know, the Jewish community in particular is much more incensed about specifically about Nazis. Not that in general they like white supremacists overall,
right.
But Nazism is a particular, is particularly homophobic, is particularly, you know, anti-feminist, is particularly anti-Semitic, and is particularly genocidal. Whereas other kinds of white nationalism may be like, oh, well, we just want second-class citizenship, or, you know, for non-white people, or, you know, other, I mean, more milder forms of what their goal is and what their rhetoric is, and tend to shy away from, you know, endorsing genocide and things like that.
Sure.
And there may not be a big difference in the end to most people who are outsiders, but, you know, it's like we wouldn't – people on the left would never group together – anarchists and, you know, Trotskyists and third world Marxists who are entryists into a popular organizing group, right? We would see the distinction. So sure. The far right and white nationalists have those same distinctions too, even though it might be a matter of subtlety and, you know, public facing. And at the end of the day, they may all be kind of have the same issues that they're pushing, because there's only so many issues you can get traction with.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, that makes sense. Thank you for elaborating on that. And my next question is, you know, one of the big things that happened in the wake of this Capitol Hill siege coup attempt, do you see this as a real coup? Maybe I'll ask you that. Do you see this as an actual coup attempt or something else?
No, absolutely not. If it was a coup attempt, Trump had his moment to declare himself dictator. That was his moment.
Oh.
And he didn't.
Okay.
I don't believe that the people involved, I mean, some, like a small minority may have, knew what they were doing. They clearly didn't have a plan.
Right.
I mean, you know, maybe a small group of them did have a plan. Maybe they had insiders to guide them and stuff, but it was clearly a very small group. The mass of the crowd, it was probably, frankly, a crime of opportunity.
Hmm.
You know, they were like angry. They marched there. They're like, oh, we could take these tiny group of police officers. You know, but a lot of them, people went inside and they were taking selfies and milling around, and there was, you know, footage of people leaving. People were streaming in and out, and people leaving being like, nothing in there, there's nothing to do. So I don't understand why that's a coup. I mean, which part of that is a coup? I mean, you know, if it was a real coup, Trump would have taken power. They would have set up a revolutionary council to announce that the Congress was disbanded. They hereby disband the Congress or whatever, whether they had the actual power to or not. I just think it's a crime of opportunity, you know. And the left would do the same thing. Let's just be really honest. If they thought they could storm the Capitol at some big demonstration with thousands of people, I'm sure they would.
Hmm. Right. I guess the goals would be a little different.
Goals would be a little different. It'd be a lot more organized. People would set up a press office. They'd be handing out free sandwiches, you know. There'd be a chill out room, and, you know, there'd be more street medics. You know, probably all these people wouldn't have died of heart attacks because there would have been street medics. I mean, that's a clear difference. And no free food. That's the other big difference.
Right. That was one of the funnier takes I saw after this, where people were, you know, saying it was Antifa that was responsible for the violence. And it's like, you don't know. Like, Antifa would be far more better organized, just like you said. Like, they know how to protest, so, you know, it would be far.
If it was the Antifa, there would be no live streamers and everyone would be wearing masks.
Exactly.
Like, I mean, rather than this is a coup attempt. They're live streaming what they're committing federal crimes and live streaming it. That doesn't seem like very together to me.
Right. Yeah, for sure. It kind of reeks of entitlement, you know. Like, I don't know how people could not think that there wouldn't be consequences. And in many ways, I understand it. I mean, obviously, if you're a leftist and you're protesting, you're going to receive a lot more hate and violence from the police. So I think leftists that are organizing in the streets understand this a lot more. And it seems like the far right doesn't seem to have that same kind of understanding of the situation. Like, it doesn't occur with them as much, where they have police attacking them. Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense that they don't. It makes sense that they don't, because it doesn't happen to them. Why should they expect it to happen to them?
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, and I think because they live, you know, the people at this demonstration in particular, because they are all conspiracy theorists or believed in conspiracy theories, like, really just don't understand like what it means. I think they really believe that they were entitled to come into, in a sense, into and invade the Capitol because it was their house or whatever. And I think they really just weren't here enough to understand that how this was going to play with the rest of the country, and that, you know, while local police may ignore certain things that you do, especially if they don't like your target as well, like that they're not going to ignore federal crimes.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think these things dawned on them.
Right. Yeah. Okay. My question here is, big tech companies like Twitter, of course, Facebook, and other like the others like Apple and Google have like taken down Parler, and also of course they've suspended Trump's Twitter account and several other people connected to him. So with all of these takedowns, I mean, is this effective in, I guess, putting a cap on, I don't know, like far right communication, organizing, you know, whether it's the MAGA people or it is actual far right individuals that are a part of that? Like, what do you think the general effect is going to be on the far right with these bans and taking down Parler and all that?
Well, it's going to be a big blow to them. We've seen over and over when they are deplatformed in mass, like not just one or two, it's a big blow to them, and it takes them a while to recover. It may well help facilitate the growth of the more insurrectionist factions. Mm. I think that's true. But, you know, it's going to make it much more difficult for the mainstream of the movement to organize, especially in the next 2 weeks. And I think that's the, you know, a week. What is it now? Week and a half. Mm-hmm. What are we on, the 14th? Less than a week. And I think that's the real crucial thing, at least at this minute, what I'm holding my breath mostly about. And not that I think there's going to be widespread violence, but there may be an attempt at it.
Mm.
So I think these platforms should have done this at the very beginning. I think Twitter should have shut Trump off in 2015. He's always been in violation of their terms of service. You know, his use of Twitter has produced an amazing reputation for that platform, you know,
mm-hmm.
that the president of it was a voice piece of the president of the United States. I mean, you can't get to be a bigger, you know, media thing than that really in the world. They should, you know, all these, you know, a lot of people talk about free speech, and I think it's a fair discussion and where this stuff will end, but there's always been terms of service on platforms, and a lot of what's happened here is just a refusal to implement them, you know? And nobody's arguing that private companies can't have terms of service or that media platforms have to give a voice to anyone. Like,
yeah,
nobody, even the most free speech absolutists aren't making those arguments. So it's a question of where the line is drawn and how close the line is. All these groups should have been deplatformed years ago.
Yeah. I actually never expected Twitter to ever take down Trump, just because he has been such a, I don't know, he's really, I mean, I imagine like I think quite literally Trump being on Twitter has probably helped Twitter as far as, you know, the value of their company. I sense. I mean, it's drawn a lot of traffic to the site, to the platform. So,
well, yeah, he's their best-selling product.
Yeah. Yeah, it just feels to me, it's just like with all like these individuals like Trump, it's just like, it's like with the media. I mean, like there's so much attention that's paid to him, and it's like they've gone on this train, even though they're being openly critical of him, but they recognize how much attention they're getting from covering him. And now that we're at this kind of almost critical mass of, you know, people storming the Capitol building, I mean, it's just like, oh shit, like the cat's out of the bag and let's try to put the cat back in it. And it's almost too late at this point. It just feels that way to me, at least.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know what to say about that. Sorry.
It's okay. I'll just say, so if they're off of these platforms, if you have more of these people being pushed off of Twitter, Parler's being taken down, etc., like where do they go? Like where do these people go to communicate and organize?
Like, well, there's always different platforms. People are going to Telegram, which just took some of the most vicious pro-terrorism, you know, Nazi channels down. But you know, they're not gonna, there are no way they're gonna do anything about Trumpists. So they'll go to Telegram. There's just other weird platforms that people can use that we don't know about so much that they will go to. I don't spend all my time on communications platforms, so I read about which ones the far right is using, you know,
sure.
in the media. So I don't think at the end of the day building a communications hub is going to be so difficult for them. It just takes a while. It takes a while to move everyone over and find everyone. And I'm sure each time you lose some people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have complete confidence in their, you know, humans are very creative and innovative, and I have confidence the Trumpists will, you know, and others on the far right will reassemble somewhere.
Yeah. Right.
And anyway, you know, I mean, 10 years ago, activism wasn't done, social media wasn't the primary vehicle of activism. I think Occupy Wall Street was the first real mass movement that was primarily built around social media. So we'll just go back to the other ways of doing things.
Right. Yeah.
Email machines, I don't know.
Right. I was just thinking when you're saying that, I'm like, yeah, you know, activism has been around a lot longer than social media. Like, no shit.
Yeah. And we forget, I mean, it's really only a decade old as a main activist tool. And people are like, well, what will people do?
Right.
I mean, I think it's hilarious with the alt-right when they talk about the fundraising. All their fundraising, you know, venues are shut down. I'm like, you can't open a P.O. box and have people send you checks? Like, really? I mean, I'm sure there must be some way you can, like, pay online to some company and they'll send a physical check. I mean, you really can't do that? Can't ask people to put cash in an envelope? People did that for... until 5 years ago, that was how it was done, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just unthinkable now for them.
Interesting. Yeah, that's made
I can't venue money for your live stream.
Yeah. Well, I think it just speaks to just, I don't know, I feel like social media and just being extremely online, you know, it does kind of... just like blind spots, like it's just these really big blind spots. Things have seemingly shifted so much just in, like you said, like just 5 years ago, that was a way that people would donate. They would send it to a P.O. box, and it's like, doesn't even fucking occur to me that, like, oh yeah, of course, like I've been staring at this screen for too long. I don't even remember, like, there was something before this that we could easily go back to, or at least, you know, people can go back to. Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, this is one of the things people tend, especially radical movements of all stripes, tend to recruit from very specific audiences. And so the alt-right has recruited from, as you say, very online people, right?
Mm.
And outside of that, it's just they don't know what to do often.
Right, right.
You know, even as late as February 2017, people were running articles, well, the alt-right, you know, is big online, but can it translate into an on-the-ground movement, you know? Mm-hmm. So they only exist, or they primarily exist in these little bubbles, but in a sense, the alt-right's kind of burned out, right? Are the people on the street now alt-right, you know?
Right.
I mean, the Proud Boys, yeah, but it's a lot of militias. Is QAnon alt-right? I mean, it's just more like a kooky conspiracy theory, and those things have been around for a long time, right?
Right.
Alex Jones is an alt-right. He has his fingerprints all over the stuff, even if he doesn't like it personally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So... you know, I don't know. They'll figure out a way to do it. They have their little ways to recruit, and they'll figure out a way around these things. But yeah, it's a weird thing about our like the short term memory of our culture. You know, maybe I'm just an older, I'm Gen X, right? Where I'm just like, oh yeah, for years we did everything on paper and stuff. But you know, a lot of stuff is only like 5 years old, so it's not like people don't remember. You know, that how you moved money around.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like really my final kind of question or topic I want to discuss is, I mean, resistance to this. Obviously, there's like I have friends that are in Portland and Salem. I know that you're on the East Coast, but, you know, you mentioned Salem, Oregon, which has been actually a hotspot of like Proud Boys, militias, these types of far right groups coming out and protesting or doing whatever they're doing. And I think in your article recently, you did mention there was a incident in Salem. Actually, it was actually a friend of mine said that someone was killed in Salem very recently by some of these groups. Really, my question is like, what resources can you direct people towards? What kind of framework can we look through to understand how to effectively, like, as leftists or as just people of conscience that don't want fascists to take over our communities? Like, what are some resources or a framework that we can look at this through so that we can effectively organize and build solidarity and resilience in the face of this?
Well, you know, I just happen to have written a guide about how you can do legal work to counter the far right called 40 Ways to Fight Fascists, Street mm-hmm. Legal Tactics for Community Activists. Mm-hmm. I did it in conjunction with Pop Mob, the popular mobilization in Portland, Oregon, who helped, you know, are one of the groups that helps organize the big demonstrations against the far right. Mm-hmm. These are tactics like how to monitor groups, how to stay, you know, or try to stay safe and anonymous, how to collect information, how to release the information, how to counter-organize a demonstration, ways you can get people of different, you know, identities and abilities, including, you know, people who have disabilities, to get them involved in different pieces of the work, mm-hmm. how to make coalitions and alliances, how to do things like prisoner support and memorials, and how to well, those are most of the things, actually.
Okay.
This is available for free on my website, spencersunshine.com/40ways. And these are the basic tactics to do counter-organizing against these groups. I can tell you right now, in this moment, I think the most important thing to do, and maybe it's not for really radical people, maybe this is a message for others, is that especially in the next couple weeks, if there's a far-right demonstration, we need to have one that swamps them. That makes it very clear the communities don't want this stuff, you know, outnumber them 10 to 1, 20 to 1. Their demonstrations aren't that big. And this should have been happening all along, but now is really the time for people in the more moderate political factions to step up and do this, and people who are more radical to, even if you've been rebuffed in the past, to attempt to make overtures to these organizations and see if you can get people out. And, you know, the Capitol takeover is a good hook for it. You're like, do you want to see that here? People are horrified by it. Do you want to see that here? The police aren't going to stop it, you know, whether that's true or not. Mm-hmm. It's a good selling point. And it's time to show up and, you know, make it clear that the community is not going to tolerate these things.
Right.
Because for sure, nobody else has stopped these things so far.
Right. So it's like, it seems to me that like, when I've seen anti-fascist organizing, that really one of the most effective tactics or ways to shut these things down is really just by numbers. It seems like sheer mm-hmm. numbers of people coming up and showing up really does the job.
See, this is a really odd thing with the Antifa movement. These tactics were designed for neo-Nazis and white supremacists, mm-hmm. in which the number of them was generally very small, usually would be in the dozens, and rarely more than 100 or 200 would have been a huge rally, and which you could mobilize a much greater number of people. Partly because they targeted so many different kinds of groups of people, and partly because people are just much more incensed at Nazis and Klans people, right? Mm-hmm. What's happened now is, first off, the white supremacists are a lot more low-key. You know, they don't wave around swastikas and march around in Klan hoods so much, once in a while, but not so much. And that these far-right groups are a little bit more toned down, that there are a few members who are Jewish or people of color or gay men, really cuts down the amount of mobilization that you know, anti-fascists can are able to draw from. And also the tactics of direct confrontation were designed for Nazi groups and other groups that were directly violent, that were violent outside of the demonstrations against people, you know, that had long traditions of murdering people. And it's not quite the same thing with the Proud Boys and other far-right groups. It's just much more difficult to mobilize mass groups of people against them than against real fascists, you know, open fascists and Klansmen.
Okay.
And that's one reason these things have gone on, where there's often the same number of people on both sides.
Okay.
Or around the same number of people. Before, you could, you know, organize 1,000 people to oppose 25 Nazis. That was not uncommon.
Okay. So the dynamic has shifted a bit over the years.
The tactics haven't changed, did not change on the Antifa side, and the dynamic has changed incredibly. You just did not see these things before in the United States, almost ever. I mean, in the pre-war period, like that big rally by the German Bund, you know, the pro-Nazi group, or it's a Nazi group, in 1939 in New York, there was a much lit, and that had, I think, 15 or 20,000 people. There was actually a much bigger counter rally outside of people desperately trying to beat them up. So in the past, it has happened, but not in the recent, you know, in recent years, because the white supremacists just weren't able to draw that many people into cities, and it was generally in far out areas that they did. I mean, there are one or two exceptions, like at Marquette Park in Chicago, but really just haven't been able to draw large numbers.
Well, isn't that that's disturbing, though, right? I mean, that it has shifted in that way.
It's a new thing that these slightly more moderate far-right factions are street factions and are this violent. This is all new. Okay. And it is disturbing. And it may be like this for many decades to come. Because for the last few decades, really until the Tea Party, these more far-right stuff didn't really do public rallies. That was like a Nazi and Klan thing, right? Mm. But this in-between area where people are not part of the really liberal, you know, democratic, you know, a parliamentary system, you know, they are fueled by conspiracy theories and like all this, you know, slightly coded racism. They didn't really do street actions. And some of them, like the militias, had weapons, but even they weren't very confrontational in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, there were instances of terrorism and violence, like Oklahoma City, but they would form these militarized units, but then the units wouldn't engage in combat, you know, as units. Right. So there's a kind of theater to it. But there weren't a lot of, especially non-armed groups, didn't really use a protest rally, especially confrontational one style tactics. They formed organizations and had meetings and tried to form lobbies and stuff like think tanks. That was their strategy. Mm. So there's been a real shift in strategy, and it may stay this way for quite a while.
Hmm. All right. Well,
on that happy note.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm like,
always the person to ruin everybody's day.
Oh,
you know that musician you really like? Yeah, he's a Nazi sympathizer.
Oh shit. Yeah. No, I appreciate the honesty about it, and I appreciate your analysis of the situation. And it definitely gives me a lot to think about, that's for sure. And yeah, Spencer, thank you for your time. We're closing in on an hour, and so I know you've as you mentioned, you're getting interviewed quite a lot these days. So thank you for carving out some time for me, and also for rescheduling. I know I had to reschedule it and change the day, so thank you for being flexible.
Yeah. Well, I love being on your show. I appreciate you inviting me, and you know, I think you do great work, so I'm happy to support you in whatever way I can.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Buy Patrick's book.
Perfect. Greatest endorsement ever. Yeah. I'll say one last thing. Of course, you're on Twitter at Transform6789. You're also on Patreon. People want to support you there. Patreon.com/SpencerSunshine. I think people should support your work.
Yeah, I just want to say I used to be affiliated with a think tank, and I don't have any organizational affiliation, and being a freelance writer is not the path to a living wage. It's not for me. So if you do like my work, please do consider contributing.
Right. And what was the name of your book again?
Well, I have a guide. It's a pamphlet. Called 40 Ways to Fight Fascists, Street Legal Tactics for Community Activists. It's free online. The text is there, and you can also download a PDF and print copies out. If you want some copies to distribute, you can also contact me via my website, which is just SpencerSunshine.com.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I'll be putting all those resources in the description of this episode, and thank you once again, Spencer, for taking the time to speak with me.
Yep, my pleasure.